Welcome to the Alaska World Affairs Council Presents on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Kristen Speck. The Alaska World Affairs Council brings the world to Alaska. World leaders, journalists, authors, educators, and entrepreneurs join Alaskans in a conversation about world affairs. This week, Dr. Michael Papazian, professor and chair of the Department of Religion and Philosophy at Berry College, speaks on the enduring legacy of Armenian genocide. In addition to his degrees from Johns Hopkins University and Virginia University, Dr. Papazian holds a Master of Studies degree in Classical Armenian from Oxford University. He has authored three books on Armenian studies, his translation of the medieval theologian Yevishe's commentary on Genesis was published in 2004, and currently in press is a book on the history of Armenian Christianity, as well as a translation of 8th century Armenian commentary on the Gospels. Dr. Papazian has also published numerous journal articles and given presentations on a range of topics, including Stoic logic and metaphysics, the medieval Armenian biblical commentary tradition, the morality of war, terrorism, and the theology of sin and redemption. Today, he is an associate professor of philosophy and chair of the Department of Religion and Philosophy at Berry College in Georgia, where he has taught since 1998. He teaches general education philosophy courses as well as several upper-level courses such as ancient and medieval philosophy, modern philosophy, and New Testament Greek. Today, he answers the question, what happened to more than a million Armenian people during those dark years of the second decade of the last century? His talk, After 9 Decades, The Enduring Legacy of Armenian Genocide, was recorded on Friday, October 17th in Anchorage, Alaska. In partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council, KSKA presents Dr. Michael Papazian.
Thank you to the Alaskan World Affairs Council for inviting me and for all of you coming here. It's really a great privilege to speak here before you. My topic is the Armenian Genocide, and I will give you a historical account of it, but I want to approach it also in a somewhat different way than what maybe what most other scholars and students of the genocide have done, because I come to this topic not as a historian or a political scientist or a lawyer, but with the rather modest skills of a philosopher. My aim here is not simply to present a historical account of the events that took place at the beginning of the 20th century, or to answer the various different complex questions about what started it going. Was there actually an intentional plan on the part of the Ottoman authorities to destroy the Armenian people? That's a very important and an interesting debate among historians of the last days of the Ottoman Empire and also of modern Armenian history, and it's definitely well worth our attention. But my talk will not focus so much on that question. As a philosopher, I'm particularly interested in questions of justice, and perhaps even more importantly, the lives of people today who still suffer from the consequences in countless ways of the historical events that occurred and the decisions that were made. History is not past. It's still with us in many ways. When we consider the legacy of the genocide, we should first note that the conditions that gave rise to it, the suspicions and hatreds between the members of ethnic groups, the extreme fanatical forms of nationalism, still exist today. To take just one recent example, some of you may have been aware that about a year and a half ago, a Turkish-Armenian journalist by the name of Hrant Dink was assassinated in Istanbul by an ultra-nationalist Turk, actually a teenager who was incited by a right-wing ultra-nationalist organization. Dink was a powerful advocate of reconciliation between Turks and Armenians. He was, in fact, critical of Armenian nationalists as well as Turkish nationalists. So what we found is that here, even just 2007, there's still this hatred that leads to violence and death. So what I'm interested in is this question of what can we do now? The legacy of the genocide continues, it's important that we understand what it was historically, but also we should use that knowledge to try to come to some sort of reconciliation, peace between nations. And it's also difficult to conduct dispassionate analysis under the current very highly charged conditions. I've been told by many people that my topic is a hot topic, and of course it is. So I would argue that the most urgent and pressing item that those of us who are concerned about Turkish and Armenian relations, and more broadly with Middle Eastern affairs, and more generally about truth and decency in international politics, that our main concern should be a political and moral one. We should be concerned with transforming the self-identity of both Turks and Armenians so that they will begin to see each other in a different light and in the perspective of a broader shared culture and humanity. There are some small but hopeful signs today that something like that is beginning to happen. And among the other things that I will speak about today, I will speak about those signs and indications of hope. So my plan is to speak briefly as I can, about the history of the genocide. I'll give an introduction to the events of 1915 and provide some background to understanding the significance of these events. After that, I will turn my thoughts to the question of what we should do now as a result of the current situation between Turkey and Armenia and between Turks and Armenians in general. My hope is that these remarks will have implications not only for Turkish-Armenian relations, but for Middle Eastern politics in general, and also for American foreign policy. So let's begin. Who are the Armenians? Who are the Turks? My own background is Armenian, both sides, both of my parents, my grandparents. I came to the United States because of the genocide. When I was growing up, if I told people that I was Armenian, no one would know what that meant. Right? It was, where is that? I've never heard of it. That doesn't happen as often nowadays, but still, it is an obscure part of the world to many of us. Geographically, the place we're interested in is what's called Anatolia. It's sort of a peninsula that is to the east of Greece, south of Ukraine and Russia, the Black Sea, north of Syria and Iraq. Anatolia is a Greek word. It means the place of the rising up, the rising of the sun, the land of the rising sun, because, of course, it's to the east of Greece, and it's where the sun comes up. But it was also called Asia Minor by the Greeks. They actually originally referred to all of Asia as what is today Anatolia. But then when they realized how big the continent of Asia is, they referred to Asia Minor, the Little Asia, as what is today mostly Turkey. About the Armenians trace their presence in eastern Anatolia and also in the Transcaucasus, what used to be the Soviet Union, but now includes Georgia and Azerbaijan. The Armenians trace their presence there at least 3,000 years, if not much more. There are references to Armenians in ancient Greek literature and in Persian literature too. Herodotus, the great Greek historian, refers to the Armenians. The Armenians have their own language, and it's not closely related to any other language, although historical linguists have shown in the last couple of centuries that it is an Indo-European language. So that means it is a distant cousin of English, French, and German, and most of the other European languages, as well as Farsi, Persian, and many of the languages of India that are descended from Sanskrit. As Dr. Cox mentioned, the decisive, perhaps the most important event in Armenian history occurred in the 4th century AD, the early part of that century. Most Armenians would say about 301. That was when Armenia adopted Christianity as its official religion, and almost any Armenian, even many confirmed atheists and secularists who are non-religious, will boast about this fact. That Armenia was the first officially Christian nation, predating even the Edict of Constantine, which made Christianity a favored religion in the Roman Empire. But while Armenians began to profess the Christian faith, they remained almost stubbornly obsessed with maintaining an identity distinct from other Christians and other neighboring people. Already by the 7th century, the Armenian Church adopted a distinct theology about the nature of Christ that separated it from other Christians, particularly the Greek and other European Christians. This distinction continues today. The overwhelming majority of Armenians, maybe 90%, at least nominally, belong to what is called the Armenian Apostolic Church, an independent, autonomous Eastern Christian church that stands apart from and is not in communion with the Greek Orthodox or Russian Orthodox Church. In other respects, too, the Armenians have defined themselves as different or unique. They use a distinct alphabet that no other language uses. It was devised by a monk in the 5th century in order to translate the Bible. The alphabet today consists of 38 letters, and as far as I can tell, it doesn't resemble any other alphabet I know of. So this sense of uniqueness and difference that Armenians have cultivated has helped to bring about over the centuries a very strong attachment to the idea of a unified Armenian nation, even though historically, if you go back, the Armenians have been geographically and even linguistically diverse and divided and given to internal dissension and rivalry. But there's been this very long and intense process of nation building, this forming of this, forging of this idea of Armenian uniqueness and difference. So while it would be anachronistic to attribute a modern form of nationalism to the ancient Armenians, it's not unreasonable to argue that there was a kind of proto-nationalism in early Armenian history that made it hard to resist the more modern nationalist movements and revolutionary ideologies that began to emanate from Europe during the 18th and 19th centuries. By this time, the Armenians were under the rule of the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire, of course, was one of the great empires in human history, founded by Osman, the great warrior and ruler who died in 1328. In the empire, he founded the dynasty that continued into the early parts of the 20th century. This is, of course, Osman and his people spoke a Turkic language, so this was the origin of the modern Turkish language as well. Many Armenians living in the Ottoman Empire, influenced not only by the ideology, but by the real nationalist stirrings of ethnic groups, especially in Eastern Europe, began themselves to call for reform of the Ottoman Empire that would recognize their rights and grant them at least some measure of autonomy and liberty. Well, it seems obvious from our present-day perspective that this movement was bound to fail, and to fail in tragic and violent ways, but that, of course, is the benefit of hindsight, of course. But back then, the 19th century, this was a time of great optimism, of the ideas of emanating from the French Revolution of liberty, equality, and fraternity, or from the European Enlightenment of the perfectibility of man. Ideas that may seem quaint to many now, even silly to those of us today living in a more cynical or perhaps more realistic age. But nevertheless, this is what people thought, that there was hope for some kind of freedom for the different nations that were under oppressive rule. It did not help matters for the Armenians that the Ottoman Empire was struggling at this time and moving toward its ultimate demise. The glory years were over, and the Ottomans in their glory years were able to conquer the Byzantine Empire and its crown jewel, the city of Constantinople, now known as Istanbul. They were able to do this in a series of remarkable military victories, and the empire was multi-ethnic, encompassing within its widening borders both Arabs and Jews, Slavs and Greeks, Turks and Kurds, and of course also Armenians. In the modern, as I mentioned, the modern Turkish language itself is descended from the Central Asian languages spoken by Osman and the other great Central Asian warriors and leaders and their people. The Turkish national identity has tended to focus on the Central Asian ancestry. And there continues to be relations and strong attachments today with the other Turkic-speaking nations of the Caucasus and farther east. Countries like Azerbaijan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan all speak forms of the Turkic language, of a Turkish language. And the Ottoman Empire, though, was governed according to ethnic and religious distinctions. The word in Turkish is millet, for a nation. Each community had its own leader, who himself, in turn, was subject to the Sultan or the Emperor of the Ottoman Empire. There was an Armenian millet, Greek and Jewish as well. In the case of the Armenians, the leader of the nation, the Armenian nation within the Ottoman Empire, was the Patriarch of Constantinople, a bishop within the hierarchy of the Armenian Church. That position still exists. There is a Patriarch of Constantinople, but of course it is now a very relatively insignificant position, since there are at most maybe 20,000 Armenians left in Turkey. So by the 19th century, the Ottoman Empire was in a position of retreat, even while its rulers were attempting to reform and modernize it. The empire faced the revolts of the Slavs and Greeks in its western provinces. These were difficult problems, but the existence of unrest among Armenians, most of whom resided in the heart of the empire in eastern Anatolia, posed a problem of much greater seriousness. Adding to the problem was pressure from the other great powers, the Europeans, who for their own reasons were supporting the rights of Christians within the Ottoman Empire, and thus were viewed by the Ottoman authorities as interfering in the empire's internal affairs. And perhaps more seriously, there was the Russian Empire, which by this time had conquered part of historical Armenia, and thus had within its boundaries a large Armenian population itself. One of the general problems of Armenian history is that Armenia has always been caught between two great empires, two great powers. In the earlier times, it was between Rome and Persia, and later the Byzantine Empire and the Persian Empire. Now it was stuck between the Ottoman Empire and the Russian Empire, and that's a very difficult position to be put into. Russia was seen as, and saw itself as, a protector of Christians living in Islamic countries. But of course, it was also an expansive and aggressive power that posed a serious threat to the Ottomans. Understandably, many Armenians looked to Russia as their emancipator from Ottoman domination. Not that Ottoman rule was always a bad thing. Certainly, the empire was tolerant of many of its nationalities through history. And it is surely true that the life of Jews in the Ottoman Empire was generally better than that of European Jews living under Christian domination. But these are generalities, and we're speaking about a particular time in history when the Ottoman Empire was threatened and felt itself besieged, when many Armenians were pushing for change, and just as a world war was beginning to start. Even before 1915, things were happening that would ultimately destroy Armenian-Ottoman relations and Turkish-Armenian relations. There was a series of massacres against the Armenians carried out prior to 1915. As many as 100,000, perhaps 200,000, Armenians died in the massacres of 1894 to 1895 during the reign of the Sultan Abdulhamid II. These are known as the Hamidian massacres. In 1896, in response to the seizure of the Ottoman bank by Armenian revolutionaries, 5,000 Armenians in Constantinople were killed. And then 20,000 Armenians in Cilicia, that's the region located along the Mediterranean coast of eastern Turkey, perished in the massacres of 1909. But the events of the genocide beginning in 1915 were unprecedented. They were of a different order from these earlier massacres. The exact figures are difficult to determine, but most objective sources claim about 1 million to 1.5 million Armenians being killed. And, of course, the survivors were displaced to other countries, so that in an act of ethnic cleansing, Anatolia was effectively emptied of Armenians. The pretext for the Ottoman actions was the beginning of the First World War. The Ottoman Empire was allied with Germany. Prior to this, a coalition of reform parties known as the Committee of Union and Progress, or the Young Turks, sought to establish a constitutional government. It's interesting to note, by the way, that allied with the Young Turks was the leading nationalist party of the Armenians, the Armenian Revolutionary Federation. At least initially, one of the major Armenian political parties supported the Young Turk coalition and thought that this was a positive step toward reform of the Ottoman Empire. Well, the Young Turks eventually did come to power in 1908, but their means of reforming the empire changed as the Young Turks became increasingly nationalist. They were looking for an ideology that would unify the people of the empire and the rulers of the Young Turks, the triumvirate of Enver, Cemal, and Talat, settled eventually on a pan-Turkic form of nationalism that viewed the Turks as one part of a greater nation of all people who speak Turkic languages. The Young Turks themselves were mainly secular. They were non-religious, and thus they did not look to Islam as the unifying principle of the empire. Instead, many of them were excited by the dream of uniting all of the Turkic people living from Eastern Europe to Central Asia into one Turkic empire. This was the dream of pan-Turkism. Of course, this was not good for the Armenians, since they're not Turkic, and they stood in the way between the Anatolian Turks and the Turks, or the Turkic people of Central Asia. An ethnically cohesive empire of the kind envisioned by the supporters of pan-Turkism had no place for the Armenians. Well, the result, according to Armenians and most historians, was genocide. The present Turkish government and some historians, however, argue that the empire was trying to deport the Armenians from the war zone, so this was not an act of genocide. For the Ottomans were at war with Russia, and the Armenians were a threat. They had a natural reason to be allied with the Russians. And many Armenians did die, but it was not because of a direct Ottoman policy, but rather because of illness or some other violence that was not coordinated by the Ottomans. But the facts seem to go against this claim. Armenians well outside of the war zone, including in Ankara, were deported and killed. The methods that the Ottomans used was essentially the same in all locations. Beginning in February 1915, the Armenians of a particular city or region were disarmed. The young men were drafted and called to a government building and told they were being relocated. They were marched out of town and then shot and bayoneted. Later, the women, children, and old men were told they had to leave their homes. They were marched out in the heat of summer and not given food or drink. They either died along the way or were sent into the Syrian desert, where most of them did die. Armenians in some places did resist, but the resistance was mostly futile. The protests of foreign governments were ignored. Many courageous Turks and Kurds, however, did hide or protect Armenians. Some of these people are known. One example is Celal Bey, the governor of Aleppo in Syria. He refused to obey orders from Constantinople to deport Armenians. And because of his refusal, he was removed from his position in June 1915. But for each of the ones of these Turks and Kurds who were known, there are countless others who also helped, but whose names are unknown. And we should note that they did this in spite of the fact that in much of the Ottoman Empire, the penalty for helping an Armenian was death. In fact, there would be as many survivors if there weren't such people who helped the Armenians. In sum, though, we can say that the Young Turks got what they wanted. They had an Anatolia that was depopulated of Armenians, and thus they unintentionally cleared the ground for Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, who was a general during World War I, but not actually an opponent of the Young Turks. But he, of course, is the founder of the modern Turkish Republic. Atatürk was able to create an ideal of a unified Turkish nation state, ignoring for a moment the persistence of a large Kurdish minority within Turkey. Of course, the Kurds are not Turkic. They actually speak an Indo-European language that is related to Armenian. But Atatürk also did not pursue a pan-Turkic agenda, but rather focused on consolidating power and building a national consciousness within the borders of the present Turkish state. So in some sense, we can say that the modern Republic of Turkey would not have been possible without the actions of the Young Turks, because they laid the groundwork for this more cohesive ethnic republic that Atatürk then built on. So that is one of the legacies of the genocide. It has made the modern idea of Turkey possible. Meanwhile, the Russian Empire itself was undergoing revolution, and in the chaos there, Armenians in Russian Armenia held on briefly in 1918 to an independent but fragile Armenian Republic before having to surrender in 1920 to the new Soviet Union rather than face the onslaught of the Turkish army to its west. Other Armenian survivors made their way to the various countries of the Armenian diaspora, you know, the idea of being spread out into other countries, ending up in the Middle East, to the Arab countries, to Europe, a very large Armenian population in France, and of course also to America. And this has remained the situation roughly up to the present with Armenians living in the diaspora situation for the most part, with one exception, and that is the virtually accidental reemergence of an independent Armenian state in 1991 in the wake of the disintegration of the Soviet Union. But this was not something that was planned, it just sort of happened. Soviet Union collapsed, well, all the republics all became independent. But this just happened as a result of the disintegration of the empire. Of course, that republic remains, it is still independent, and it has outlasted the two-year, very short-lived empire, republic of 1918 to 1920. Something else that has not changed, and as I noted before, is the enmity existing between Armenians and Turks. The anger and hostility periodically makes its way into the media and the newspapers. Whenever a resolution is proposed in the U.S. House of Representatives to commemorate April 24th as a Genocide Remembrance Day. April 24, 1915, was the day on which Armenian intellectuals, politicians, and other leaders were imprisoned and later executed in Constantinople. Armenians marked this date as the start of the genocide. The Turkish government always protests and uses all of its available resources to suppress the resolution. That includes things such as the threat of not allowing Americans to use the Air Force bases in Turkey. In addition, there's something of a taboo about Armenia and Armenians in Turkey today. The monuments of Armenian culture. I've been to Turkey twice, actually. Once I actually did go into eastern Turkey. I went to the cities and the villages where my grandparents came from. But you'll find ruins of monasteries and churches. They are rarely, if ever, identified as Armenian. And you'll find in Turkey today often a response of defensiveness and suspicion to all things Armenian. On the other side, many Armenians themselves remain bitterly hateful toward Turkey and all things Turkish. The most violent manifestation of these reactions were the terrorist acts perpetrated by Armenian organizations, mostly during the 1970s and 1980s. That included the assassination of several Turkish diplomats. So while Armenian terrorism is basically a thing of the past, the conditions that led to acts of terrorism and revenge have not changed. There's no reason why, you know, people wouldn't still be motivated to do it now. And it's this current state of enmity, of hostility, between the two nations that really is my main concern and has to do with the second part of my talk, to which I will turn now. The basic question is this: what can we do to repair the situation, right? This hostility between the two people. It's not only bad because it leads to violence between the two people, but also because it's somehow self-destructive too. First, let me say that there are many signs of hope today. And I'll point to several examples of that. Turkish intellectuals and scholars, and in general all Turkish people of goodwill, have begun to re-examine critically the standard Turkish position that there was no genocide. They do this with great courage, given the stakes and the dangers involved. So I'll note here just the comments of the Nobel laureate Orhan Pamuk, the great Turkish novelist, who has spoken out about the genocide. But less well known are the efforts of Turkish scholars and professors such as Taner Akçam, a sociologist and historian at the University of Minnesota, who has written extensively on the genocide, as well as Fatma Muge-Gucek, a sociologist at the University of Michigan, who has, through organizing various email discussions and other forums, promoted and fostered dialogue between Armenians and Turks and other scholars with an interest in the area. We really have to be grateful. I just mentioned three. There are others as well. We have to be grateful for the work of all of these people who face death threats wherever they work, and in Turkey also face prosecution for insulting Turkishness, which is a crime in Turkey. We should also note the outpouring of support for many Turks after the assassination of Hrant Dink. There were demonstrations in Istanbul, for example. And Turkey today, this is all evidence that Turkey today is a more open society than before, and there's an increased interest in the past that embraces its multicultural heritage. That's encouraging, and I think that that should be fostered. But at the same time, we should also note that there have been strong and often violent manifestations of the unreconstructed nationalists who waged a backlash against the pro-Dink demonstrations. Well, given these developments, I think that we live in an especially critical and decisive time, what the ancient Greeks called the kairos, the opportune moment for action, when people can, with the right measures, bring about a significant change in the current intolerable state in Armenian-Turkish relations. The change will not occur, though, until both sides realize that it is in their best interest to change. The excessive and destructive nationalism found both among Armenians and Turks has severely distorted and corrupted their souls and has inflicted damage upon their cultures and civilization. It is time that people of goodwill acted to temper and control this nationalism, which ultimately is an ideology that fails to recognize a common humanity. And we need to work to transform that nationalism into a more moderate and noble form of patriotism, which does not base its love of country on hatred of some enemy. Well, that sounds good, but how can you do it? How can you transform people's souls? And even if it is possible, what does this have to do with politics? Here I'm speaking as a philosopher, and in particular as a student of the great ancient Greek philosopher Aristotle, who wrote in his book, The Nicomachean Ethics, that those who seek to study politics must first study the soul. And I say this because we should be aware that governments have some authority and power over the cultivation of the souls of their citizens. They control education. They can develop their citizens in the way they think is right. And so, just as an educational curriculum that focuses on the greatness of one's own nation and the evil and inhumanity of one's enemies will only foster more hatred, an approach that properly cultivates a concern for truth and an openness to the critical examination of one's assumptions and prejudices can have a positive effect on future international relations and justice. What I'm calling for is something like this. Let's have the Turkish schools recognize, if not the genocide, I realize that's a lot to ask for, that at least the existence of Armenians and their positive contributions to Turkey. On the other hand, also, let's have the Armenian schools study the Turks who stood by Armenians during the genocide, and to study also the situation of other minorities within the Ottoman Empire, such as the situation of the Jews, to get an idea that maybe the events of 1915 are not representative of Turkish or Ottoman history as a whole. In taking the focus away from the genocide, we will be moving away from a nationalism of grievance to a patriotism of pride in the legitimate accomplishments of our cultures. I'm making this distinction, right? Patriotism is a form of love. It's a genuine virtue, right? But nationalism is its perversion. It's rooted not in love, but in the hatred and demonization of others. That in itself, I think, would be a major first step, right? But is it possible? Well, I think the times are auspicious for a number of reasons. First, the political culture in Turkey is itself evolving away in some interesting ways from the nationalist ideology of Ataturk, or what's known as Kemalism. Turkey has been governed by a Muslim political party, Justice and Development, for the past 5 years. The Justice and Development Party has so far prudently followed what has been called a moderate Islamist policy, focusing on social welfare programs. Indeed, in a protest held on April 14, 2007 in Ankara, the Turkish capital, the protest was held by secularists against the Islamic ruling party. The worst criticisms that a New York Times reporter could elicit from the protesters was that the Justice and Department Party had issued school religion textbooks that were too attractive, and that state workers were allowed to take time off for prayers on Friday. These are outrages that can hardly be compared to Islamist policies under the Taliban or in neighboring Iran. Because of the strong secularist pressures from the military and the judiciary in Turkey, the Justice and Development Party has had to develop this very prudent and moderate approach to governing. Instead of being alarmed by this, Washington should encourage it and warn the secularist forces in Turkey from attempts to undermine by illegitimate means the actions and policies of the Justice and Development Party. The formation of a moderate Islamic government in Turkey has several potential benefits. Islam as a supranational religion, I mean, in other words, it's not based on one nation, but it is above nations, can serve as a tempering force and a check against the strident nationalism of Kemalism, of the ideology of Ataturk. If there's any hope for a recognition and respect of non-Turkish nationalities in Turkey, it will probably come from a government based on such a moderate form of Islam. Now, I may be a little bit too optimistic, but I think there is at least hope here. There is a possibility. Because on the other side, the concern is that if you let the Justice and Development Party, you know, develop too much, it'll just become not moderate Islam, but actually radical. But if you have those effective civil checks on it, some kind of system of checks and balances, perhaps that kind of interaction can actually form a kind of moderate Islam, can sort of emerge from that, moderate Islamic rule. To personalize my point a little, let me note, there's a fascinating article in last Tuesday's New York Times. The article was front page. It was entitled "Youthful Voice Stirs Challenge to Secular Turks," written by Sabrina Tavernais. The reporter tells of a young woman, her name is Hava Yilmaz, age 21, an observant Muslim, who in an act of rebellion has worn an Islamic headscarf, an act that has ostracized her, as it has many other women, in a number of ways from Turkish society. Right? This is a serious offense in Turkey. It's a breach of the Kemalist principles of secularism. So Yilmaz, however, has exhibited a confident and courageous virtue by remaining true to her principles, principles that include, as the reporter writes, reaching out beyond religion to include all groups in Turkish society, like ethnic and sectarian minorities. It's precisely people like Hava Yilmaz that I have in mind when I speak of the hope of a moderate and modern Islam in Turkey, and of the sort of virtue and goodness of soul that I hope the authorities in Turkey will seek to promote rather than suppress. But why should Washington work to support this movement and risk alienating the secularist Turks, who have been such strong allies? Well, there's a broader concern that should work to motivate the United States. Currently, I think Turkey is not a credible model for other Islamic states. Its aggressive secularism alarms Muslims who are pious, while its strong sense of Turkish nationalism alienates Arabs and other non-Turkic nationalities. But if Turkey is able to become more tolerant and open, it can become a serious and compelling model of Islamic democracy. This was actually part of the Bush administration's stated goal for the war in Iraq. Other than the weapons of mass destruction, they also said Iraq could be formed into a model Islamic democracy in the heart of the Middle East by displacing Saddam Hussein and establishing an Islamic democracy. Right? Well, it's not clear if that goal will be met, but there is reason to be optimistic about Turkey rather than Iraq as an effective model for the Islamic countries. And if the United States government wishes to back democracy and democratization in the Islamic world, its best bet may be to promote and foster the growing voices in Turkey calling for a freer and more democratic country. If these voices prevail, then the Islamic world will have produced a powerful counterexample to the contention made by many that Islam and democratic citizenship are mutually exclusive. So I think there is an incentive for the U.S. to back movements in Turkey toward a less nationalistic and more open society. And a less nationalistic Turkey will benefit Armenia and Armenians too, who will have to tone down their own nationalistic rhetoric and policies as well. For the nationalism of the Armenians, while it is in many ways an understandable reaction to the genocide, is nonetheless destructive. It has reduced the Armenian sense of nationhood and identity to one of suffering and grievance. Now the main event in Armenian history has become the genocide, and the great positive achievements of the Armenian people have tended to be minimized or eclipsed by the commemorations of April 24th. It has also resulted among some Armenians anyway, in a kind of inwardness and cautious conservatism, especially in the diaspora, signs of which include an unwillingness or a reluctance to recognize the suffering of others, including those of the Anatolian Greeks and the Assyrians, who suffered very much in the same way during the period of the genocide. That's beginning to change. We're seeing some encouraging developments on that front in well. But in closing, I think I'll just say that I would counsel Armenians to devote their political Armenians in America, American Armenians, to devote their political activities in the U.S. Not only toward passing a genocide resolution in Congress, but also trying to influence the U.S. government to take a constructive role in promoting democracy and reform in Turkey. The passage of a congressional resolution commemorating the genocide is a small honor to the memory of the victims and the survivors of the genocide. A greater honor will be a result of both Turks and Armenians acting together with the support of the American government to show that enmity in the Middle East or anywhere else need not be permanent, and by working together to establish a tolerant, stable, and open democracy that will serve as a model for all of the troubled nations in that region and beyond. Thank you.
You've been listening to Dr. Michael Papazian, professor and chair of the Department of Religion and Philosophy at Berry College in Georgia. Following this talk entitled, After 9 Decades, The Enduring Legacy of Armenian Genocide, he responded to questions from the audience. First, he was asked, are you proposing that reconciliation with the Turks and Armenians would somehow foster reconciliation between the Turks and Kurds? How are these conflicts related? An audience member asked.
Yeah, I think that's a very, very good point. And because you got the same situation there. I mean, with the Kurds being a separate ethnic group, but of course their identity has been suppressed, and of course there's been violence there as well. I focused on the Armenian situation, but I wanted to propose this also as a general model for reconciliation between people, especially in this region. And I think that we've noticed that as there's been sort of more openness to Kurdish rights in Turkey, there's also been a more openness towards Armenia as well. So those two things are definitely seem to go together. Right. So whatever fosters one should also work to foster the other. That's the hope anyway.
In reference to the massacres that occurred before 1915, another audience member asked, did the Armenians live in specific areas where they could be identified and thus murdered, or is there an obvious ethnic difference between Turks and Armenians?
Yeah, generally, Armenians and Turks did not live together, so it'd be easy to identify, you know, which areas are Armenian districts, which villages are Armenian villages, and all that. Yeah, and because your political identity was you were defined in terms of your community, right? So that there actually are good reasons why you would want your identity as an Armenian or as a Jew or as a Greek to be known, because ultimately your at least your immediate allegiance is to that community and to the leader of that community, and then the leader of that community reports to the Sultan. So just the actual political structure of it made it very easy to be able to identify who's who.
Next, assuming the interest of the United States is to promote reconciliation between Armenia and Turkey, how is that intent promoted by the genocide resolution before Congress? Another audience member asked.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was actually going to talk more about that. I don't think it does, right? In other words, I was actually going to make a perhaps more imprudent remark, and I changed it this morning. I was originally going to advocate that Armenians agree to drop the genocide resolution if Turkey shows a good faith effort that it's attempting to reconcile and normalize relations with Armenia, simply because I think resolutions don't really mean anything. They don't change historical facts. The genocide was a historical fact. I don't care if Congress recognizes it or not. And so it seems to me that that's not something that it's not a big deal. The only thing that it is a big deal for is it's actually a very powerful weapon in the hands of the Armenians in making the genocide known better. not because the resolution passes, but because every time Turkey resists it, it makes front page news in the Washington Post, the New York Times, it gets on CNN. So the Turks have given no incentive to the Armenians not to have a resolution, because it's one way in which everywhere I go, people ask me about, when if I tell them I'm Armenian, you know, people say, oh yeah, I heard about the genocide. Well, would they have heard about that if Turkey was so resistant to the resolution? Because Congress is constantly passing resolutions that nobody ever hears of. Never gets in the front page of the New York Times. Only when it only gets there when a NATO ally says, you know, we're not going to let you use that airbase if this thing passes. So really, it's a very powerful weapon in the hands of the Armenians that they can use as a negotiating tool.
After World War II, Germany was compelled to change the education system and rewrite textbooks and take field trips to France. Then Japan was doing the same thing, but now it's shied away and it doesn't even talk about events such as the Rape of Nanking. How do you compel an unbeaten country? How do you compel a strong Turkey to change its textbooks for an event they consider insignificant? Another audience member asked.
And I don't know if I... it's not clear to me that they're insignificant, because Turks seem to be obsessed with Armenians. So I wouldn't characterize the Armenians as insignificant. Maybe the Armenians are insignificant, but the Turks don't seem to think that. That gets to my Aristotelian point, that in essence, this is not a matter of compulsion, right? Aristotle has this thing that, you know, here's how you raise kids. You raise kids in such a way that, you know, at first you force them to do things, right? Have that piano lesson. They don't want to do it. But then eventually when they get into it, oh, this is really cool, I like this, I like playing the piano, you don't have to compel them anymore. That kind of Aristotelian model of education is what I'm looking at. Now, I don't know if, you know, why it seems not to have been working in some places rather than others, but the idea is it's not a matter of compulsion. The compulsion is only at the beginning, and it's easy to get kids to do things, right, because they're small and all that. But when they grow up, they're not doing it because their mother is going to punish them. They're doing it because they want to do it. And so that's what we're looking to do. We're actually looking to transform souls. That's what I mean when I say transform souls. It's a very Aristotelian concept, that this is how you nurture and cultivate certain values, right? And that's what I'm looking for.
Next, an audience member asked Dr. Papazian, if the Turkish nation is an Islamic state, as you say, what is the connection between church and state? And what is the significance of this relationship in terms of the Armenian genocide?
Yeah, what I was saying was that the government currently is an Islamic government, but the state itself, I mean, is officially secular. There is no official religion. Since the time of Ataturk, Turkey has had a very resolutely secularist policy, right? Even though I think upwards of 95-99% of the people of Turkey, or at least nominally, are Muslim, right? So what I was saying is that officially there's a very strong separation between, state and mosque, I guess you would say. But, of course, since the culture and the overwhelming majority of the people are Islamic, of course, you can still identify Islam as sort of the main religious tenor of the Turkish people, even though, in terms of the government, there's no official sanction, I guess, of Islam. What I was basically arguing was this, and I may be too optimistic, but the significance there is what I'm saying is actually that Islam can be a kind of a moderating force, if applied properly, on nationalism, right? Because Islam is not a nation, right? And it encompasses many nations. It's actually a universal religion, right? The idea is you can be a Muslim and be of any ethnic group. And whereas nationalism, of course, focuses just on that one particular ethnic group. So that if you want to have a kind of a reconciliation between nations, Islam can be one of the means by which you can achieve that. Because if your ultimate allegiance is to this idea that there's this basic truth that applies to all human beings, and you're not simply saying that one nation is better than another, then there's more of a possibility of an openness to reconciliation with other nations. In practice, that doesn't always work out, right? But at least in theory, it should. So what I'm saying is that part of the ultra-nationalism of Turkey is the result of that Kemalist ideology, which has sort of rejected Islam and has become very secular. And that if you want to sort of, one way you can sort of moderate that kind of nationalism is by having a kind of a non-nationalist or anti-nationalist ideology balanced against it, and Islam would be one. In principle, Christianity should be too, because again, it is not a nationalist ideology. Christianity doesn't say that one nation is better than another, right?
Last, a woman in the audience asked Dr. Papazian to highlight some of the advocacy organizations or other individuals in the United States who are striving for the reconciliation Dr. Papazian spoke about.
I've mentioned a couple of names. It's primarily, I mean, I guess one of the reasons why my familiarity with them is more with these groups rather than others. I'm more familiar with the academics and intellectuals and professors who are interested in reconciliation. And part of the reason for that is just because I'm a professor and that's the circle I travel in. So this may be unrepresentative, but there are many, and I've spoken with and have gotten to know many Turkish scholars. I mentioned one, the University of Michigan sociologist Fatme Muge Gucek, who is a very, very active, very good force in bringing together Turkish and Armenian scholars. So while she doesn't have an organization, as far as I know, she's at least one voice in the wilderness there who's working towards reconciliation of Turks and Armenians. There are many others, too, that I could name. I don't know of any actual organization. I can say that this organization is working toward that. But I know that there are many very good and capable individuals who are interested and active in this area.
This concludes Alaska World Affairs Council Presents with Dr. Michael Papazian, professor and chair of the Department of Religion and Philosophy at Berry College in Georgia. Dr. Papazian responded to questions from the audience following his talk entitled, After Nine Decades, The Enduring Legacy of Armenian Genocide, recorded at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage, Alaska, on Friday, October 17, 2008. These broadcasts are produced by KSKA Public Radio in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. Visit kska.org to sign up for free podcasts of Alaska World Affairs Council Presents. You can also sign up for email updates about the show or share your comments with us and other listeners. This has been a presentation of KSKA in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.